Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. We have Thomas Friedman and Michael Mandelbaum to begin today's show. And here's one reason I'm glad we do. To me, one of the most important things that happened in the last week of August got buried in the news by the earthquake and hurricane. You know, the weather events that were sent to remind us that the East Coast is full of heathens.
You think by now they get the message. An earthquake, a hurricane. Are you listening?
Michelle Bachmann there with a wink, not as earnest as when Reverend Jerry Falwell said 10 years ago next week that America got what we probably deserved on 9/11.
What we saw on Tuesday, as terrible as it is, could be minuscule if in fact God continues to lift the curtain and allow the enemies of America to give us probably what we deserve. We make God mad. I really believe that the pagans and the abortionists and the feminists and the gays and the lesbians who are actively trying to make that an alternative lifestyle, the ACLU, People for the American Way, all of them who tried to secularize America, I point the finger in their face and say, you helped this happen.
Reverend Jerry Falwell on September 13th, 2001. Appropriate to the 10th anniversary, right? Maybe Bachmann will return to that theme in the presidential debate tonight. Who knows? But will it play in New Hampshire, which, according to Google Maps, I looked it up, is on the East Coast? By the way, you can join our politics team for a live online chat during the Republican presidential hopefuls debate tonight at 8 o'clock at our politics website. It's afreecountry.org. 8 o'clock live chat. But I digress. The story that got buried in the hurricane news was a key line in that much-anticipated policy speech that Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke gave in Wyoming. He calmed the stock markets that day partly by saying, quote, "The growth fundamentals of the United States do not appear to have been permanently altered by the shocks of the past 4 years." Keyword, permanently. I'll say it again. Quote, "The growth fundamentals of the United States do not appear to have been permanently altered by the shocks of the past 4 years." Ben Bernanke on August 26th, the day before the storm. But in Thomas Friedman's New York Times column today, he quotes an essay written by the dean of the Public Policy School at the National University of Singapore. And listen to this quote. "No U.S. leaders dare to tell the truth to the people. All their pronouncements rest on a mythical assumption that recovery is around the corner. Implicitly, they say this is a normal recession. But this is no normal recession. There will be no painless solution. Sacrifice will be needed, and the American people know this. But no American politician dares utter the word sacrifice. Painful truths cannot be told." So the ultimate scary issue is in play. Not the small bore questions of the moment, like whether President Obama should announce a new public works program or cut payroll taxes in his speech tomorrow night, but whether we are living in a permanent post-Lehman Brothers world, post-housing bubble world, post-American century world that we will never return to again. Ben Bernanke says, no, not permanent, don't worry, which calms the markets for 10 minutes. The Singaporean dean, Kishore Mahbubani, says, yeah, maybe permanent, without a different notion of sacrifice. And really, so do my first guests today. Thomas Friedman, the New York Times columnist, and Michael Mandelbaum, director of the American Foreign Policy Program at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. They are out with a new book called That Used to Be Us, How America Fell Behind in the World It Invented and How We Can Come Back. Tom Friedman, Michael Mandelbaum, thanks for coming on to discuss this important book. Welcome back, both of you, to WNYC.
Great to be with you.
Good to be with you.
Michelle Bachmann and Jerry Falwell aside, Tom, is my framing too apocalyptic? Do you think the issue on the table is permanent decline or not?
Oh, absolutely. And that's really the theme of That Used to Be Us, Brian. Michael and I wrote this book because we fear that the American dream is now in play. The notion that every generation will pass on to the next a higher standard of living is now in play, and that won't just affect America, because the American dream is so essential to America's ability to project power into the world, to be a stabilizing force, and to be a model of democratic capitalism that other countries will want to follow. And we wrote this book because neither of us want to be on duty when the American dream goes dark.
And Michael, for you, as well-known as you are as a foreign policy expert, people might not have thought that you would write a book or co-write one with Tom Friedman about economic decline. So I ask you the same question about the specter of permanent decline and how you see the economic and the rest of foreign policy intertwined.
Well, we actually wrote this book because we discovered that our conversations about foreign policy always ended up with domestic policy and with the challenges that the United States is not facing, let alone mastering. And we concluded that the most important foreign policy issue today and for the next decade is domestic policy. It is renewing America, saving the American dream, and thereby making it possible for the United States to sustain the kind of foreign policy that it has played and that we think it is important we continue to play. Foreign policy really does begin at home, and that was the motivation for our book.
Listeners, we want you in this conversation. We've been asking on our Facebook page all morning, is America in permanent decline? And people are answering yes, and people are answering no. But we want to ask you, what does America need to avoid permanent decline? 212-433-WNYC. Talk with Thomas Friedman and Michael Mandelbaum. 212-433-9692. You can ask them a question if you want, or give us your opinion of what America needs to avoid the scary specter of permanent decline. 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. Or you can post it on our website to our politics webpage, itsafreecountry.org. Itsafreecountry.org. What does America need to be to avoid permanent decline? Or call us up, 212-433-9692. Tom, that quote in your column today from Singapore says what's needed here to prevent permanent decline is sacrifice. But he doesn't lay out what he means. And usually, I think I hear this most from Democrats who raise the word to say the rich should be paying more taxes if we're going to spend the decade after 9/11 borrowing $1 trillion to wage two wars. But is it more than that?
Well, what we argue in the book, Brian, is this, that, and the reason the book is called That Used to Be Us, the reason it has a book about the future has a backward-looking title, is precisely because we believe we had a formula for success in this country that we've gotten away from. This formula has five basic parts, and it goes back to Hamilton and to Lincoln, and has been repeated by every and reinvested in by every successful president. Those parts are investing in education, so we ensure that we have a population that is capable of mastering whatever is the technology of the day, whether it's the cotton gin or the supercomputer. Second, building infrastructure, so we have the world's best roads, airports, bandwidth, telecom, etc. Third is keeping our country open to the world's most energetic and talented immigrants so they can come to our country and start, 40% of the new companies in Silicon Valley every year. And fourth, it's having the right rules to incentivize investment and risk-taking but prevent recklessness. And lastly, it's government-funded research to push out the boundaries of knowledge. Now, so our entrepreneurs can then pluck the best flowers and turn them into new companies. Now, what we argue is that we need to get back to that formula for success. And the way we have to do that, given where we are right now, is with a hybrid politics that involves doing three things at once. We need to cut spending because we have made promises to the future generation we cannot keep regarding Social Security and Medicare. Second, we need to raise taxes because we cannot put the whole burden on simply cutting these social and entitlements programs. We need to raise more revenue. And thirdly, we need to invest in these five pillars of success, which we haven't been investing in at the scope and scale we need in order to get back to be who we used to be. The solutions are here. They are within us. But it requires today a hybrid politics.
And Michael, is sacrifice inherent to that? Sacrifice in a way that average Americans are not willing to get their minds around so far?
Well, some short-term sacrifice is necessary, and that means sacrifice by all of us, not just the wealthy. The wealthy should certainly pay their share, but this has to be a national effort. And we have to recover the spirit that we've had in the past of meeting challenges, of understanding that we are all one country, of practicing what we call in the book sustainable values, that is, values that will tide us through the long term, rather than the situational values of the last decade, which involved just doing whatever you can get away with at the moment. So it's a matter of sacrifice, certainly in the short term, but it's also a matter of recognizing the world we're living in and having a plan to apply those sacrifices to bring us back to what we were. And above all, it's a matter of recovering some traditional American values that we've drifted away from in the last decade.
Thomas Friedman, Michael Mandelbaum with their book, That Used to Be Us, How America Fell Behind in the World It Invented and How We Can Come Back. We have a full board of callers who want to chime in on what the United States needs to do to avoid permanent decline. And Seema in Somerset, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling. Good morning.
Good morning. Brian, I'm actually from India, and I've come to this country and I've started my own office. I feel that one of the reasons that America is declining is because of the loss of the manufacturing base. When other countries can provide goods at one-third the cost and it's flooding our markets, people are not wanting, the manufacturing base is gone because all the factories are moving offshore. We are giving a lot of corporate subsidies to a lot of firms, and we are not, sort of providing some opportunities or incentives for people to set up firms here, and I think that is something that needs to be addressed.
Seema, what about...
We cannot allow cheap goods to be flooding our market without, providing some kind of incentive for people to set up firms here and offer their own, our homemade goods.
How would you do that? Because when you talk about manufacturing, we've lost so many manufacturing jobs to countries including India,
right,
where people are willing to do those jobs for a lot less money,
right,
that, the multinational corporations don't see the profit in it, and then the workers, if they were to only offer India-level wages here, wouldn't see the incentive to take the jobs, presumably. So what is a globalized economy manufacturing base in America? Do you have an idea of what the economic model is for that?
I don't know much about the economics, but I was thinking one of the things we could do is maybe give them some tax breaks for companies which would manufacture in this country, which would employ workers here in this country. You know, at the moment, I think we are not doing that. And I think that's another reason why all these companies feel that they could, manufacture elsewhere and bring it in here and sell it cheap.
Do you think India is doing something right, that we're doing something wrong as a matter of national purpose?
Well, India has a lot of educated workers and who are working well, but they also have their success seems to be largely because of the export market that they have.
Yes.
Thomas, we don't seem to have that. I was just thinking maybe there may be some way to create some incentives for people to manufacture in this country.
Thank you so much for your call. Thomas Friedman, your reaction?
Well, we get into this in detail, Brian, in the book. About maybe a third of the book is really about the new world we're in terms of technology, what that means for parents and students and workers regarding education, and what it means for entrepreneurs. Now, let me take up directly, Seema's puts a very important and good point she raised. We, until last year, were actually the world's largest manufacturing nation in terms of value of products produced. In fact, only this year, only in the last year, did China actually overtake us in terms of total volume. So we're not out of manufacturing. What we are out of is low-end manufacturing. But in terms of producing, the high-end value-added products, we are right there with China. The difference is China produces the same amount of manufactured goods we do with 100 million people, and we do it with about 11 million people. Brian, that's not going to change. And that's why we have a chapter in the book called Average is Over. Because basically in this more highly integrated, connected world, employers now have access to more machines, more robots, more software, and not just cheap labor, but cheap genius from the Indias and the Chinas. And therefore, everyone is going to have to bring and be educated to bring some extra to their job. So we actually profiled the oldest manufacturer in Buffalo, New York. Now, to be a manufacturer for over 100 years in Buffalo is a real challenge. It's a company called Eastman. They produce cutting tools. And it's a fascinating story because you can see how the family, the founding family, which still runs the company, has adapted to everything. And yes, and they offer good blue-collar jobs with good benefits, but instead of one employee working on one machine, now one employee runs four machines. So when one employee can run four machines, that employee can then be paid like four foreign workers. That is really the key. The key is knowing what world you're in and then adapting in a really smart, flexible, and ingenious way, pulling a little from China here, a little from the technology here, a better trained worker there, mix it all together. We actually have a lot of companies doing that, a lot more than people realize. And what our book tries to do is profile those companies and show the formula they're using to educate their workers and then produce in this way.
But Michael Mandelbaum, is that enough? I mean, you guys are both advocates of free trade agreements, and I think the theory is to let China and India and Mexico take the low-end industrial era style assembly line jobs and will produce intellectual property to export to the rest of the world. But many critics now say that model doesn't work. There aren't enough jobs inventing iPods in the United States to compensate for the jobs lost making iPods in China.
Well, as Tom said, those jobs are not coming back. And really, we don't want them to come back because they're low-wage jobs, because we have the same manufacturing output as China with one-tenth the labor force. We can pay 10 times the wages that China can. We do not want to pay Chinese-level wages.
But can we pay it to 300 million Americans?
Well,
are there enough of those jobs, or are the adults in that population? Are there enough of those? Because some people now are saying the industrial-era economy, even though no one likes working on a boring assembly line, was uniquely good for middle-class growth because it created all these decent-paying jobs, especially once unions got in the act, that required mass numbers of people. And today's economy doesn't.
Well, that's a very important point and one we take on head on. I would say this. First, we can sustain at least as many manufacturing jobs as we have now if we do what we recommend in the book, and that is invent more high-end products for Americans to make. But that means better education. It means more investment in R&D. It means an appropriate regulatory environment. But it is the case that most American jobs are going to be in the service sector. Just as we move from the agricultural to the manufacturing sector now, we're largely moving from the manufacturing to the service sector because we can do manufacturing much more efficiently. And service jobs are the future, but service jobs are under real pressure from cheap genius. And that's why we say in the book that average is over, that everybody needs some kind of extra, some way to distinguish him or herself, to keep the job, a service job, against foreign competition. And that goes back to a subject to which we devote a good deal of attention, and that used to be us, and that is our system of education. Our system of education is our front line for economic progress, and it needs much more attention.
Michael Mandelbaum, Johns Hopkins foreign policy expert, Thomas Friedman, the New York Times columnist. Together they have authored That Used to Be Us, How America Fell Behind in the World It Invented, and How We Can Come Back. And we can come back after this short break and continue this conversation. And with your calls, how can we prevent America from going into permanent decline from this ongoing economic slump? 212-433-WNYC, or post it to our politics website, itsafreecountry.org. More with Thomas Friedman and Michael Mandelbaum in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Thomas Friedman and Michael Mandelbaum. Their new jointly authored book is called That Used to Be Us, How America Fell Behind in the World It Invented, and how we can come back. And we're asking you on the phones and on our politics website, it's afreecountry.org, to post your solutions to how the United States can avoid the scary specter of permanent decline. We played that Jerry Falwell clip before, but here is another more down-to-earth rant about how we deserve what we're getting. You practically open your book with this quote from Governor Ed Rendell of Pennsylvania. Speaking of earthquakes and hurricanes, this was after the infamous snowstorm during Christmas week last winter when the blizzard caused the cancellation of a Philadelphia Eagles football game. And Rendell said, "It goes against everything that football is all about." And then more generally, "We've become a nation of wusses," said Governor Rendell. "The Chinese are kicking our butt in everything. If this was China, do you think the Chinese would have called off the game? People would have been marching down to the stadium. They would have walked, and they would have been doing calculus on the way down." And here is Rendell expanding on it to NBC News.
What happened here Sunday night was emblematic of that. Tom Hanks said no crying in baseball. We don't cancel football games for bad weather. We used to be a nation of risk takers. That's how we were born. A bunch of farmers and shopkeepers took the risk of fighting the strongest army in the world. And that's how America came to be. And we're losing that.
Now, Michael Mandelbaum, I cringe at parts of the original quote, some of the stereotyping, like, you know, Chinese people would be doing calculus on their way marching through the snowstorm to the football game. But is there a point you're trying to make about not just American economic policy decisions, but American character?
Well, we use that quote because it expresses what we found to be a widespread feeling that we're on the decline and China is on the rise. And what we say is that our feelings about China are really feelings about ourselves. What we see in China is something that we used to have and fear we don't have now. And in some ways, we are losing it. China's capacity for collective action, for addressing problems head on, is impressive. Ours used to be impressive, but isn't as impressive as it needs to be anymore. But we add that our problem is not China. We don't need to imitate China. We say that China has a second-rate political system and we have a first-rate political system, but China is getting 90% out of its system and we're only getting 50% out of ours. So the moral of the story is we do have to go back to what we used to be. Risk-taking is part of it. Sacrifice is part of it. Looking problems squarely in the eye is part of it. As Tom implied in his column today, telling the truth is part of it. Our point is that we are risking permanent national decline. We're on a slow decline. And the way to reverse it is to go back to the practices and the values that made us a great country to begin with.
How do we avoid permanent decline? Listener in Queens writes on our webpage, "The bottom line is that the U.S. standard of living will drop back to where it was after World War II, and many Americans will learn to live in apartments again, but America will go on, possibly not as the superpower, super-duper power," he writes, "it once was, just as Britain goes on, but no longer as the imperial empire that it still was before World War II. Thomas Friedman, is that the long historical view that maybe is inevitable now that, you know, we're not the only country in the world that doesn't have its economy on its knees, as happened during the Cold War?
Well, Brian, it's a good question, and it really comes down to, will our decline be relative? That is, we're rising, but other countries are rising as well, and maybe faster and catching up. That's fine. Or will it be absolute decline? You know, will we literally be falling back? We really think that is what is in play now, but we really believe that that does not have to be the outcome. That we really believe that, you know, again, we call the book That Used to Be Us because we didn't get here by accident. We didn't win in every historical turn as a country. By accident, we got here because we had a formula for success. And we need to get back to investing in that formula. And we would argue the reason we're in the hole we are in, and we document this in the book, is precisely because we've gotten away from that education, infrastructure, immigration, the right rules for investing, and government-funded research formula. And we've really had a generational shift from a greatest generation that believed in saving and investing in that formula to a baby boomer generation that has been more given to borrowing and spending and basically living off the investments from a less competitive world that the greatest generation made. And so we've got to get back to who we were. It's not about China. It's not about India. It's about us and what we can do and what we are and are not doing.
Charlie in Garden City. You're on WNYC. Hello, Charlie.
Yeah, hi. Good morning, Ryan. Love your program.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Yeah, first of all, I think that this country is blessed with great geography since we're both an Atlantic and Pacific power. And I think that that in itself will always keep the United States a wealthy country. We might not be the wealthiest. But comment really is that the authors were talking about other countries emulating us. But I actually think that we need to start looking at other countries and looking at what makes them successful. For example, here in New York, I mean, we consider ourselves the financial capital of the world. But there's still a lot more that we could do. So why not look at countries like Singapore or even Hong Kong, which are very successful with service-oriented jobs, and try to emulate what they're doing there to make our service industry much stronger, with the result being more jobs?
What are they doing there, Thomas Friedman? Singapore always comes up. Hong Kong always comes up.
You know, what they're doing, and again, is what we're trying to do in the book. Here's the most important thing they're doing, Brian. It isn't a policy. It's that they're starting every day by asking one question. What world are we living in? What world are we living in, and what are the biggest trends in this world? How are we starting our day? Well, way too often at the political level, we're starting our way with one party or the other, saying, how do I take this crowbar and put it in the wheel of the other party? Or how do I take what the other party said and cast it in the worst possible light? You played a couple of bits of some of the most extreme versions of that. One of my favorite quotes in the book is one we got from a Singapore economist who said to us, you know, we in Singapore, we live in a thatched hut with no doors and no windows. We feel every change of breeze, every change of temperature. You Americans live in a brick house with central heating. You don't seem to feel anything. Well, our brick house is developing some real cracks in the wall and in the roof and in the windows, and the wind is coming in. We need to start the conversation with what world we are in. That's the most important thing we've gotten away from.
Is it expectations then, Michael, of too much material comfort if they're willing to live in those huts in Singapore and work those jobs? Here's another comment from our website. It says, Justin writes, until Americans let go of the need for Me Too type material goods, there will always be cheap goods flooding our market. Americans who complain about the scale of their pay and continue to purchase the cheapest available goods without consideration for where they are made will continue to see their jobs disappear and wonder why. So there are a few thoughts in that, but I think one of them is about the, you know, assumption of being able to have this Me Too type material goods standard of living.
Well, we are in favor of a rising standard of living, and one of the points we make is that historically a rising standard of living has underpinned many of the things that we value about America. We cite a study that shows that, or at least that argues, that in times of economic growth, America has been much more generous, that liberty and opportunity have expanded. So much of what we care most about in the United States comes from economic growth, and this book is written to tell Americans how we can sustain economic growth in the years ahead. We cannot do it by drifting, by abandoning our values, by pretending, by thinking that we're entitled to a high standard of living by virtue of being Americans. You know, there's been a debate lately about exceptionalism, American exceptionalism, and whether America is an exceptional country. And what we say is America has been an exceptional country, but exceptionalism is not a distinction bestowed on a country once that it gets to keep for life, like an honorary degree. Exceptionalism has to be earned every day, like a baseball player's batting average. And lately, we've been in a slump.
Anna from New Jersey writes on our webpage, I am from Costa Rica, a country that has seen a lot of tech companies open call centers where some of my relatives work. I hear the complaints here about companies shipping jobs overseas. Do we really want the $10 an hour jobs to stay here? I think we need to create different jobs that pay more and require higher skills and let those low-paying jobs go somewhere else. So Anna from Costa Rica becoming very American. Tom, I want to finish on the politics,
please,
which you just mentioned. We will hear a Republican presidential hopefuls debate tonight, and we will hear President Obama's job speech tomorrow. He's supposed to talk about things like continuing a payroll tax cut and having a relatively small public works infrastructure program. We'll probably hear more things like this that Mitt Romney said speaking yesterday about giving the middle class certain tax breaks.
The place I really want to make a difference is for the middle class. And one way I'd like to do that is to help people in the middle class be able to save their money. Now, how do you do that? I will eliminate any tax on your savings if you're in the middle class. No tax on interest, dividends, or capital gains. Let's be able to save our money.
So, Thomas Friedman, my question to you is, will either thing in the next two nights, and by the way, listeners, we will be live chatting during both of them on itsfreecountry.org, will either the Republican presidential debate tonight or President Obama's speech tomorrow address these issues at the level of the book?
Well, we hope so, but we doubt it. You know, again, you know, Michael and I have not written a book for tomorrow's newspaper. We don't have an opinion particularly about what is the best way to stimulate the economy in the short run. Our argument is we didn't get into this problem in 2008. We got into this problem by doing the most dangerous thing a country can do. We misread our environment at the end of the Cold War. We thought it was a victory. I mean, it was a victory, of course, but we thought we could actually put our feet up. In fact, by winning in the Cold War, we unleashed a world with 2 billion more people just like us, competitors. And then we created the ways for them to compete, connect, and collaborate with us more efficiently. Then, unfortunately, we spent the last decade after 9/11, tragically and maybe necessarily, chasing the losers from globalization rather than the winners. And through all that, we forgot our formula for success, or we certainly drifted away from it, and we underinvested in it. That's what we have to get back to. That is the only long-run solution. If there are short-run things to get us through this cycle or that. I hope the president and the Republicans can agree on them, but ultimately we've got to get back to the big picture, the formula that got us here in the first place.
So in your opinion, the president and those men and women who would be president are not addressing the fundamental issues when they say they're addressing the fundamental issues. And I don't want to end this without noting that you call for a strong third party to put forth these values and ideas. Is there even a weak one today? I know the Starbucks CEO, Howard Schultz, helped promote with a full-page ad in the Times yesterday a conference call last night sponsored by the centrist group No Labels. Is that something to watch? Is there anything that could become a strong third party that would carry this message? And is there a constituency out there that cares?
Michael, what's your take on
that? We believe there is a constituency. And we believe that there's a very strong chance that there will be an independent candidate who we hope will express the values and promulgate the agenda that we believe is important for American renewal.
Next year?
Next year, watch this space.
Have somebody in mind?
We don't have a candidate. We have an agenda. It's the agenda that matters. It's the agenda that we set out in That Used to Be Us. It's the message, not the messenger. And the message is, this is what we have to do to avoid permanent decline.
But we just did a four-part series, Michael, on independence with our political reporter, Anna Sale. And when you look at the data, most independents seem to be disaffected liberals or Ron Paul libertarians, not that many centrist swing voters who you may be aiming at.
Well, the data that we have seen and the people that we have talked to suggests strongly to us that there is a large constituency of Americans who are concerned that we're not facing the real issues. Now, the only way to test that is to have a serious independent candidacy espousing a radical centrist philosophy and program. And I think there's every chance that there will be such a candidate next year, and then we'll have a chance to find out.
Come on, Tom, nominate somebody. Talking about Bloomberg here?
Well, you know, it could be a Michael Bloomberg. It could be a Michael Bloomberg and somebody else. You know, again, I really want to stress, this is a nonpartisan book. We have an agenda, and if it's Obama who pursues it or if it's Mitt Romney, God bless them, we'll be behind them.
Thomas Friedman and Michael Mandelbaum, authors of That Used to Be Us, How America Fell Behind in the World It Invented, and How We Can Come Back. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
And listeners, keep the conversation going at itsafreecountry.org. Thomas Friedman and Michael Mandelbaum will talk more about it in person tonight at 7 o'clock at the Russian Tea Room in Manhattan. But this is not exactly a Barnes & Noble book signing. It's a $85 event, unless you're a member of the Hudson Union Society. And again, don't forget the Republican debate tonight at 8 o'clock. We will be doing a simultaneous live chat on our politics website. It's a freecountry.org. Join us then. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, we will introduce a brand new collaboration between WNYC and the New York Times with deep data and your stories about your New York City public school. It's called School Book. Stay with us.